Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Why Am I So Happy? Paula Vale here, your host, and I am also the host of Choices, Finding Your Joy on WBTVN, Women's Broadcast Television Network. I am so happy today to have just a remarkable man and author with us today. Today, I am sharing with you James Okun, MD. He is a Phi Beta Kappa graduate of Duke University and a graduate of the prestigious Albert Einstein College of Medicine in the Bronx, New York. Dr. Okun did his transitional internship at Framingham Union Hospital in Framingham, Massachusetts. I am so happy to have you here today, James. I want to say welcome.
Well, thank you, Paula. Thank you for having me. I'm very happy to be here today. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Oh, you're so welcome. And I'm just so excited for the fantastic information that you're going to be sharing with all of us. I am really excited. I would love to begin with a bit of your background and, you know, tell us a little bit about, you know, your college years and what it was like to be at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine and what brought you to where you're at today.
Well, sure, Paul. I appreciate that. Yeah, basically, I grew up on Long Island out in New York, then went down to Duke University, and that's where I did my undergraduate degree. And it was very interesting. They had a course there which was in stress control. And got very interested in that because, you know, as you can imagine, especially among the pre-medical students down there, everybody was very stressed out all the time, you know. So it was very interesting. Took the course and then got even more interested in the effects of stress on the body and wound up forming a student organization, which we called the Duke University Center for Tension Control. And we started bringing in outside speakers for workshops. The reception was great because, as I said, there really was not much else that the students had available in terms of dealing with their stress. I even went out to Chicago. There was a doctor out there by the name of Edmund Jacobson, who had been a researcher at Harvard University, and he was inventing what they call progressive relaxation, you know, where they tense different parts of the body and learn how to relax them by feeling what the tension level is. So that was pretty good. I basically did that over the 4 years at Duke. And then luckily I was accepted into Albert Einstein up in the Bronx, you know, which was not too far from where I grew up. And of course that was very intense, very competitive as well. And the interesting thing was they offered a course up there in hypnosis. And so I found that very interesting as well as an alternative medical type of treatment. So I had an interest in alternative medicine, you know, just from the experience at Duke and then at Einstein. And then, interestingly enough, I decided to go into ophthalmology, you know, to learn to be an eye surgeon. So in the last part of medical school, last 6 weeks, I actually went to England to Moorfields Eye Hospital. And there I was able to learn about, the English system of medicine, their emphasis on preventive medicine as well, which was very interesting. And then things really became pretty personal because it turns out I had developed an eye disease, believe it or not. And this condition is called keratoconus, kerato meaning cornea from the Latin, and conus meaning forming a cone. And this was diagnosed, I had to go see an ophthalmologist to get into the ophthalmology program. You know, they want you to have perfect vision because, of course, you're operating on people's eyes and you need to be able to see well. And so I had the, went up to Mass Eye and Ear in Massachusetts in Boston, had the physical, the pre-ophthalmology residency physical. And lo and behold, the doctor told me that he said, you know, we've discovered a condition in your corneas, which is this kerato conus. And basically what happens is the cornea, instead of being flat, forms a kind of like a cone-like shape. And so as the light comes in into your eye, you know, it's kind of like if you're driving along and your windshield is dirty and you're seeing halos, that type of thing. Night vision is poor, and vision generally in glasses is poor. So the treatment is contact lenses, hard contact lenses. Problem was, if you have this kind of irregular cornea, as you can imagine, Paul, it's very hard to fit those, you know, to fit the cornea, and the lenses tend to pop out. So as you can imagine, I was pretty shocked that I had this condition, and especially going into ophthalmology. So problem is that really, other than contact lenses, hard contact lenses, the treatment is basically a corneal transplant, and in one or both eyes. So being in the field of medicine, especially having been over at Moorfields Hospital, I had seen, and then doing my residency when I started that down in New Orleans, I would see all kind of complications from patients with corneal transplants. So the transplant could fail, stitches could break, they got infections, that type of thing. So I was really almost afraid of going blind from this condition. And then the other problem was in medical school, I had contracted herpes, genital herpes, which was, you know, pretty prevalent at the time. So I had two conditions which kind of, I guess, humbled me a bit. I guess, you know, the thing is, as a medical student, and as you said, it was a very prestigious medical school, very competitive, and then also coming from Duke, my attitude, I don't believe was the best. Had a tendency not to want to be critical of myself at all, as a lot of us are. And so I would say having these two medical conditions sort of humbled me, and I was open to alternative type of treatments. So what I did was I started investigating things like Tai Chi, as I mentioned, hypnosis, different kinds of body work, took some courses in that type of thing, and even went out to a two-week course out in Whitewater, Wisconsin, and this was a holistic type of retreat, basically, and it was very interesting because the doctor who was running this retreat had been an ophthalmologist himself, and he had almost gone blind from macular degeneration, which you probably heard of. It's very common, and they lose their central vision. And he was basically, you know, running this course for people with severe eye conditions. And it was on a nice farm-like setting. So we did things like holistic dieting, different types of group settings and that type of thing. So people there were really at their wit's end with some type of eye condition. So basically, what happened after that was came back from that. I was still in the ophthalmology training program down in Ochsner in New Orleans, but I was really not getting any relief from the problem with the keratoconus. So you can imagine I would be going into operations in the operating room and would have a lens pop out sometimes, or the eyesight was not as sharp as I would have liked. So I was still looking for other types of treatment because I certainly didn't want to go through a corneal transplant, as you can imagine. And lo and behold, I was at Ochsner, had just resigned from my ophthalmology residency after the first year, and was on the lunch line, and I saw a very attractive young lady. I decided to go up and speak with her, and turns out this was my future wife. Aww. You know, we speak about synchronicity,
yes,
about being in the right place at the right time. And we just started talking, and it turned out she was also from New York, as I was. And I started telling her that I unfortunately was going to leave my residency, that I was worried about basically going blind. And she started telling me that, you know, she had also grown up in New York. And lo and behold, she had studied a philosophy in New York City. It was called aesthetic realism. You know, I had not heard of that. Even though when I was in medical school, I would go to New York City and look for other alternative type of studies, and things like actualism and different things like that. But I had never heard about this. So it turns out this has kind of been suppressed by the press since its inception, you know, back in the 1940s. And the founder was Eli Segal, who was a poet and a critic. And she just told me that this had really helped her life by studying this. She had also become a consultant, was teaching in New York City, and then came down to New Orleans. So it was kind of a miracle. And I was at my wit's end, and here was something that she said she thought might be able to help me. As you can imagine, you know, after all the work to get into medical school, all the work with the applications, you know, even though I go over to England to study, pretty much my career was at a standstill. Not only that, I was worried about losing my eyesight. So basically she handed me a book that Mr. Segal had written. It was called Self and World. And I started to read it. And again, being kind of a medical snob in a way, you know, being never having thought of having to look at my attitude. As I read the book, the first thing I said was, well, this seems like gobbledygook. I really don't understand what's being said. I would guess I was used to just skimming through medical books and, mm-hmm. you know, as we did in medical school, that type of thing. But it did indicate that, you know, when you look at your attitude, I know this is a lot of people are studying it these days. It basically said that, you know, we all have a way of seeing things, all have a way of looking at the world in general, and that this needed to be looked at. So, it basically spoke about being critical of your own attitude, you know, critical of the ego in us. And most importantly, it described that, you know, all of us basically, and we've all been through this, we have a pretty much a drive in us and everybody to have contempt for things and be superior and not want to really listen and not want to learn. And just another thing, just to be, let's say, angry and get into a mood where you're angry and then you forget about everything that you were grateful for.
Yes.
So it really asked me to look at this attitude that I had, you know, from early on as a child. I think growing up, you know, I had a lot of anger issues, and then that had continued on. So what happened was is I, you know, started looking at my attitude, and then we started studying. My wife and I would study different objects. You know, we would go out to, let's say, the levees in New Orleans, of course, you know, before they all broke with Katrina. Mm-hmm. And we would study an object, and she would take something as simple as a leaf. I always get choked up thinking about it because I was, you know, in such deep emotional pain at the time, having left my residency and you know, being worried about going blind and having the herpes attacks. And she would just say, you know, we would look at something like a leaf, and, you know, she would say, you know, we see this leaf here. It has one side. On this side, it has another side. We'd flip it over and look at the other side. And then, you know, she would say, you know, do you have two different sides? There's one side of you that is positive, you know, gets up rearing to go in the morning, sees good in people, thinks there is good in the future, is very hopeful. And then here's, you know, we flip the leaf over, and then here's the other side. You don't like anything. You're very selfish. You're kind of, you know, feeling depressed, feeling angry, and really don't really have the like for people that you should have. So basically, one side, you know, being totally for your ego and for yourself, the other side wanting to respect things, you respect things in medicine. You know, I was studying the eye, and we look at things like seeing what does the eye do? Does the eye push together near? The eye push together far, you know, for near vision and distance vision. So we would ask the question, you know, are you like that? Is there something in you that's very interested in yourself, interested in your own situation, your own family, whatever problems you're having, and then there's an entire world out there. So, you know, lo and behold, we looked at these different concepts, and then, you know, we'll speak more about what's actually in the book with them, later on.
Yes.
And what happened was, believe it or not, that the cornea started flattening. And whereas before I had great trouble seeing in glasses, you know, I would drive to the hospital and drive back, and I would sometimes get lost in my own neighborhood. because the night vision was so poor. Mm-hmm. And lo and behold, the corneal vision started getting sharper and sharper. Had the cornea start flattening down. You know, my ophthalmologist in New Orleans couldn't believe it. They were able to fit me with lenses for the first time there. And I was able to, you know, see and drive in glasses as well as in contact lenses. So this really was miraculous because, as I said, what they were promising me was corneal transplants. And I had, just as a sideline, had gone to see a doctor out in California, and a technician had come in to basically put two little contact lenses in my eyes that didn't fit. And they said, well, you're going to be a candidate. You're going to need two corneal transplants. It's just a matter of time. Call us up when you want it. In the meantime, we had sat in the waiting room and spoke to a patient there who had just gone through the corneal transplants and, you know, all of the stitches broke and that type of thing. So basically, nothing else had really helped me. As I said, I was being in New York, 20 minutes from New York City, Greenwich Village, where Mr. C was teaching aesthetic realism. I just had never heard of it. And here it was, and I was traveling. I went to Brazil. I went to mud baths. I was studying all over the country because I did not want to get sicker and then and go blind, basically, right, or have corneal transplants. But yet, right in my backyard there in New York, you know, was this study, aesthetic realism, and it just is not known. So not put out in the press. There's no articles and nothing published. And basically, you know, it teaches you a way which doesn't require money. It doesn't require medication. It doesn't require surgery. But it does require you being, you know, a good surgeon, I guess you might say, in terms of your attitude. You know, where can you be a better person? So, you know, where, let's say, if you're being very angry and something has happened, or like we talk in the book about the patient Steve, you know, where can you balance your emotions? And I know this has a lot to do with your work in Reiki.
Yes.
Where can you, you know, achieve this state of homeostasis in which you're not basically tearing your body apart? And in Mr. Siegel's work in the book, Self and World, he has a chapter there on self and disease, and he talks about the original meaning of disease, which is lack of ease. So basically, if you're stressed out all the time, you know, you're nervous, you're upset, getting sicker and sicker, weaker and weaker, and having a bad effect on your immune system, that you can actually, this is what I did, start looking at your attitude, try to achieve a better balance between your emotions. And another thing I started doing was writing down one thing every day that I liked and was grateful for.
Oh, I love that.
And the act of doing this, and we speak about it in both the books, the act of actually, you're getting outside yourself, getting out of your comfort zone, and writing down, what is one thing that I really liked in my day today? Even something like my, you know, but really meaning it, something like my cup of coffee, or reading this poem, or something, or just, you know, beautiful sunset. That's forcing yourself pretty much to see that as bad as you feel, as depressed as you are, as upset as you are, you have another side that is liking things, is looking for respect for things. And then basically you can put together these two emotions in yourself and try to get into the state of dynamic tranquility. It was kind of like, yes, if you look at the sunset, you look at a sun setting and you see it has tremendous energy,
mm-hmm,
and yet it's very tranquil. It's basically the sun is sitting there, but yet radiating tremendous energy. And so the question is, do we want to be like that? Do we want to be dynamic when it's necessary and then tranquil when that's necessary? So if we're always dynamic, always jittery, angry, upset, you know, what happened to the other side of us, and what is that doing to our body? The other thing I learned was, which was totally new to me, that as I started looking at my attitude, I started seeing that there's actually a pleasure that you get from being, let's say, mistreated, misused, misseen, thinking the world is bad, you're thinking people are against you. There's actually a pleasure that you get from that, kind of unconscious, but we all have that going on, and that Steve talks about, you know, that can really lead to even things like insanity and disease if it goes too far.
Yes.
So I was not aware of any of that. This is all internal things that were going on. And again, I felt, well, this is a great compliment to what I've been studying, because I've looked at a lot of alternative treatments and this doesn't cost anything. I don't have to spend $5,000 at a retreat for it. And lo and behold, it all started working. The herpes outbreak stopped. And I was able to track down emotionally where that was coming from, which was conversations with my mother on the phone, believe it or not, were having a very bad effect. And I was able to track that down, because each time I would speak with her on the phone, she would basically have a way of building me up and tearing me down during the conversation. I think that goes on a lot of families, of course. But what I found was, well, 2 weeks after that, I would get an outbreak. Mm-hmm. And then it would happen again, and then it would happen again. So I was able to track that down and see how I was using those conversations. So again, it was an example, Paul, of seeing where I had to be critical of my own attitude, where this level of contempt I was having was absolutely destroying my body. I was getting, you know, this certain aggrandizement from it. And I know my wife said one time, she said, I've never seen anybody have more contempt for their mother than you do. So it wasn't a good attitude. I had to look at it. And as I said, lo and behold, it's 31 years later, and I have not wound up with corneal transplants. I actually went into, and the herpes attacks have stopped. In addition, my wife, believe it or not, by the grace of God, never contracted the herpes virus, and we had a normal baby girl as well, because that could be contracted during birth, of course. So, you know, here it is, 31 years later. Recently went to an optometrist to have my lenses checked, and his first question to me, even though he had been seeing me for a couple of years, was, well, Dr. Oken, have you had your corneal transplant yet? And I said, no. and he couldn't believe it.
Yeah.
He could not believe that a patient with this eye disease 31 years later basically has corneas that flattened and came back to normal. So as you can tell, I'm a very grateful soul, and yet I always have to look at the other side of being ungrateful and basically try to put them together.
Yes.
And achieve homeostasis from that.
Yes. So, That is so exciting.
In a large nutshell, yes. that's pretty much the early years.
Yeah, and it's just so exciting, the message you just gave us. I mean, this information, it's just really exciting. The philosophy of the aesthetic realism is so exciting. I mean, what people can do with, you know, it puts them in control, doesn't it?
Yes. And the thing of it is, as I said, I had never heard of this, and yet it all made perfect sense, you know, with everything else that I was studying.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, I was just not aware that I needed to be, it was more important what I had against myself than what I thought other people had against me, you know, people that I wasn't getting along with, the family members, that type of thing. And this also is what helped, you know, actually 50 patients that we had all had similar good successes, you know, with stopping the herpes outbreaks just by understanding what was working in them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this concept of being critical of yourself rather than just blaming the whole world, you know, I was really pretty much a big blamer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this person did this, this person did this, this person did this, or whatever. And then this idea of looking at yourself being so important. And again, as you know, as a medical professional, I think the problem was, well, I had never read about aesthetic realism in the New York Times. It wasn't in the medical books. It wasn't when I did my internship at Framingham, Massachusetts, where they studied risk factors for heart disease, was not spoken of there. And even though I was interested in stress, I hadn't heard of it there either at all. There was no publicity, no publication. of it, but the concept is really, how can you become a better critic of yourself? How can you see what's working in you to your detriment? Where can you basically be a better person?
Yes.
Have goodwill for people. You know, one thing they talk about in aesthetic realism is the elevator test. It's like, let's say you're in an elevator. There are other people in the elevator with you. And the question is, do you want to have, there's three things you can do. One is you can have a good effect on the person that's in that elevator. The second is you can have no effect on them, just ignore them. Or the third effect is you want to have, you can have a bad effect on the person. So if you think about it rationally, of course, what would we want to do? We would want to have a good effect on the person rather than a bad effect. So I guess the biggest thing is, you know, it talks about this ethical unconscious that we all have that wants to have a goodwill for things, wants to provide for people, wants to have the best effect possible. And yet there's always this other side that we have to look at. So it's kind of like if you look at the heart, and I used to tell the students when I was teaching about the different aspects of the heart. So we say, well, the heart, you have one heart, of course, the heart contracts and the heart expands. And that's all happening in one heart. So if you can have these two things working simultaneously, you know, why do we become so arrogant that we refuse to look at ourselves and see, well, where could I have one side of me wants to like things, the other side of me is selfish, is not interested in anything but myself, and why can't I not put these two things together? So
yes.
I would say that's probably was the hardest part of the study was I had to be learn to be critical of myself, especially of this contempt I was having and the pleasure I was getting from it. So,
yes. You
know, I can read a little bit of exactly what that's talking about.
I love it. Well, James,
we
are going to pop out a moment for a break. So
Okay. Everyone,
James and I will be right back. I am just loving this. I love this. All righty, just a moment. Be right back, everyone. Hello, everyone. This is Paula Vale, founder of Wellness Inspired and host of the Why Am I So Happy show on BBS Radio. My passion is sharing the beautiful healing modality of Reiki with the world. I help you reach a new level of self-awareness and create a more confident and empowered version of yourself. Learn how Reiki will change your life. Go to wellnessinspired.com. When you live a life with love and compassion, you allow your blessings to manifest. Check out my Reiki training and Reiki practitioner mentoring program and look for my soon-to-be-released ebook, Why Am I So Happy? At wellnessinspired.com and the paulavnetwork.com. Big hugs to everyone. Paula V. Hello, everyone. Welcome back. If you're just popping in, I am here with James Okun. Oh, my gosh. He is a MD with just absolutely fascinating training. But we are discussing, he just shared his past history and shared a bit about the philosophy of aesthetic realism, which is just huge. And I know you've written a couple books. Before we jump back in, James, please share with everyone the names of those books and where they could purchase those.
Okay, sure, Paul. I appreciate that. The first book is called Erasing Scars, Herpes and Healing. And we originally put the book out in hardcover back in 97 and republished it again in 2013. It is in an ebook form. You can purchase it on Amazon.com. Again, the name is Erasing Scars, Herpes and Healing. And this book basically goes into my story, my history, pretty much what we went through today. And then also we have several patient actual transcripts in the book describing what those patients went through, and also a description of how the virus works itself and the actual structure of the virus. So that's on Amazon.com is the best way to pick that up. The second book is called The History of New Innovations in Modern Medicine. And subtitle is New Thought and Threat to Traditional Medicine. And this book just came out a couple of months ago, again, available on Amazon.com. And in this book, we go into a number of different medical innovators and basically discussing what they went through in order to have their innovations accepted and the struggles that they had to go through. And these are life-saving innovations, things like the dialysis machine, which saved my life, things like Foley catheter. We talk about psychosomatic medicine. We talk about, again, Eli Segal's work in aesthetic realism. We also go into Edgar Cayce, the sleeping prophet that a lot of people are aware of, and what he went through and how he helped people. So basically, this is a book that also describes a lot about disease states, kidney failure, prostate issues, prostate cancer, cancer in general. So again, this one, The History of New Innovations in Modern Medicine, is available on Amazon.com. And I have an author page there, which is the best way to contact me and also to buy the book. And then also, as I said, the first one again, Erasing Scars, Herpes and Healing, which is also on Amazon.
Love it. Love it. Oh, fantastic. I would love to have you share any examples such as Steve, a former Marine, who was an actual patient with herpes. Would you like to share that to give us another example?
Sure, sure. Yeah, this is very interesting because when I was practicing in Louisiana, practicing in a general practice clinic, it actually was up in Opelousas, Louisiana, and this was a sliding scale clinic for patients, and they basically would come in and pay the fee of whatever they could afford. So one particular day, I was in my family practice clinic, and this patient came in by the name of Steve, and first thing that struck me was he was had a massive build, like a bodybuilder. And so it turned out he came in, and I also noticed he had a really, really horrible condition on his face. And he began to tell me his story. And what had happened with him was he had been in the Marines. He's had served our country in the Marine Corps and had developed this terrible rash on his face. They had gone ahead and cultured it, and indeed they found out that he had the herpes virus on his face, herpes 1, HSV-1. So commonly, as you probably know, herpes 1 affects the face. Herpes 2 is the one that's genital herpes, sexually transmitted. And so I started to question him about his history, and it turned out that this had gotten so bad in the Marines. First, they didn't want him sharing utensils with anybody. Then they didn't want him drinking out of the same canteen as anybody else. So he was out at Camp Pendleton out in California where he was doing his training. And he described how this came out in boot camp with all the stress of boot camp. And basically, the condition started getting worse. They first started treating him with Zovirax, which is an antiviral cream. And he said he would lather on this cream. He described for me what basically they had him doing. And he said they would take a little scrub brush and have him actually scrub the scabs off of his face. As you can imagine how painful that must have been. Mm-hmm. And then he would apply that that Zovirax cream. So he said it helped a bit. It would help him somewhat, but then he would just break out again with the stress of boot camp. So basically, they wound up discharging him. I think he had an honorable discharge from the Marine Corps, but the underlying condition was, I don't believe that they wanted him with this condition going into battle and continuing in the Marines. So he was pretty crushed that he had to leave the Marines because of this. The other thing was socially, he said he became very concerned with it. It would be very awkward. People would say, you know, hey, what's that on your face? They would think he was coming down with something, like he said, people worried it was AIDS or it was contagious. So he became kind of a pariah in his own neighborhood with his own peers. And then we got into the fact that another problem he was having was that he had been fired. It wasn't enough to have this all over his face and have been thrown out of the Marine Corps, but he had recently been fired from an oil refinery where he was working there in Louisiana. So he had no job. He had this terrible condition on his face. He had no money, basically. He was living with his parents, which is super stressful as well. Couldn't find a job. And basically couldn't, the worst part of it was he couldn't afford his medication. It was, I think he said it was at that time, back in 94 or so, he said it was, I think, $36 or something for the tube. He couldn't afford the pills, the Zovirax pills. And so basically he couldn't get any treatment, couldn't afford it. So basically I did a complete physical, did a history, went ahead and you know, prescribed his Zovirax to him. And then because it just kind of has struck me, I guess, soul, and almost chokes me up a little bit, but I felt that I had been so helped by what I had studied. And since I began to study aesthetic realism and the outbreaks had stopped, and I found a way to track that down and was no longer having those, I thought, well, maybe I could help him as well, not only through the medication, but through understanding, just basically understanding him and what he was going through. So I basically set up an appointment with my wife, and I spoke with him. And that's one of the consultations that's in the book. And just to get a little bit deeper into, you know, what he was going through, what he had been through early on. He was a big football player and in high school, and very good football player, also a punter, and I think a defensive back. And the problem was in his local neighborhood, turns out he was being teased all the time. He's been called a dumb jock, things like that. So he kind of really had a chip on his shoulder because he thought people were against him. People didn't like him before. And then once he broke out with the herpes on his face, it was also way up into his scalp, believe it or not. And so he not only was being mocked as a big muscle building jock that people, maybe they were jealous of him, but they certainly didn't like him. And but he was living at home. We asked him what he would do every day. And he said he would, his parents would basically make him breakfast and dinner. He was on a special weightlifting diet. And he would take a look at the want ads, couldn't find a job. His mother would tell him that you'll do things, take the garbage out, things like that. So he found that very demeaning. Instead of earning his living, his bills were getting higher. He was having no income coming in. So he was pretty desperate, and yet the condition in his face and scalp were getting worse. So so we sat down for a consultation with him, and basically started getting into his attitude. And I can have the book right here. And if it might be appropriate, I could just go over a couple of questions.
Sure.
Since you asked about that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, sure. So basically, we told him that in this part, it says here, my wife was asking him right here. She says, do you think so? Do you think there is something in us that is like the virus itself? ? Do you think we trick ourselves? ? Dr. Okun just described the virus. What does it do? It sleeps 10 days. And when it feels like it, it comes out, and then it goes right back in, right into the nerve cells. Now, why does it not stay asleep? Why does it come out? What brings it out, do you think? We have studied for 10 years the virus. We have finally understood what it is in us that brings it out. Okay, and then we go on to say, we read a little bit from, here's another segment. So my wife goes on to say, because it turned out that he had considered actually killing himself and suicide, because she asked him, you know, have you ever thought of, do you ever get depressed? Do you ever not want to even eat? And he basically told us that he had even, you know, thought about suicide because his life was so terrible. No job, this condition on his face. And even his girlfriend, he said, was thinking that maybe he caught this condition from being in the military, being overseas. So even she, he felt no one was understanding him. So then we said here in this segment, we said, we go, and you are, she goes, and you are alive. In the meantime, you are being buried. Okay, we're going to tell you. Eli Segal, the founder of Aesthetic Realism in 1940, described that in all human beings that is exactly like the herpes virus. And it is called 2A pleasure, 2-A. And all of us have it. And it is why everyone on this earth has the herpes virus and it doesn't come out. We all have it. We all can have it. All of us, because of that tendency in us to make less of God's work. To make that beautiful flower less red because we want to blame God for everything. So we take the color out of reality, and it's called 2A pleasure, and you can read along with it if you like. And any questions, if you want to stop, you can ask us, and we will stop. So I just read a little bit of what's here, because this is exactly the same thing that had a good effect on my life, because I saw, well, you know, I may have been through a lot. I may have developed these two diseases, the eye problem and now the herpes infection, but that still didn't give me the right to have a bad attitude and not to be fair to things and to have this, you know, contempt for people. So here it is. So we had Steve actually read this. The act of reading it himself seemed to be very beneficial. So here is Steve reading from Self and World, 2A Pleasure, describing Eli Segal. Okay, quote, it is to be presumed that every self has two sides. What one side likes, the other side doesn't. So my wife asked him, do you think that is true? Steve says, the quote, the bad side, continue reading, has been talked about a great deal, but has not been permitted heretofore to talk adequately in its own behalf. So she asks him, do you think, well, one side of you likes, the other side doesn't? Like sometimes you feel you want to have breakfast, comma, but something in you says, no, don't eat anymore, you're getting fat. So Steve says, no, I eat, I love food. And he was a big, big weightlifting type of guy. And then she says, ah, do you love food? And Steve says, I follow a good diet. I love to eat. So then she says, sometimes you don't eat, every day you get up full of appetite. You want to eat every day. You have never gotten up not feeling hungry. So Steve says, if I'm depressed or whatever, and then she goes, okay. And Steve says, I eat, but I think about being depressed after I'm done eating. So she says, so one side of you liked the egg a week ago, but another side of you didn't like it Tuesday because something happened to you. And that is what we are trying to explain. Why do we have to not like what we've always liked because something has happened to us? Yes. Why do we take it out of the egg? Why do we take it out of the flower? Why is that? We are going to understand that through what Mr. Segal wrote.
Yes.
So Steve continues on reading. Quote, here it is permitted to talk in the first person and show how, quote, wonderful it is. To be sure, there is also the bottom by the whole self. Okay, so this is from, again, 2A Pleasure from Self and World, the self. Steve is reading this. Like every other human being, I'm in a fight between two kinds of pleasure. In order to decide between the two, I must see both for what they are. I have in the past accepted the pains, very great, which have come with my having the pleasure, which aesthetic realism calls ego, in quotes, or 2A pleasure. If this pleasure is greater than the other, it would be unwise to give it up. It would be sanity, good sense to continue it. Let me try to make this pleasure as attractive as possible. Okay, then he continues to read, 2A self, one. It seems to give me a feeling of pure individuality where I don't have to undergo the humdrum competition with other persons that seems to make up such a great part of the present world. Okay, Steve reads number two. I can endlessly despise. And the more I despise, the more apparently logically my own ego is glorified.
Yep.
That's one of my favorites.
Yes.
I really
yes.
Three, I get a sense of triumph from being invisible from humans. I can also relate yes. to that one. She goes, "That's like the virus. Steve reads, I can hide with greater conscious glee." And then she reads the next one, "And I can come out in 10 days when I want to." Steve reads, "4, I'm in touch with perfection. The boring and imperfect have nullified." This is the bad side speaking. 5, I can make fun of everything I want. Speaking about mocking all the time there. 6, matter, objects no longer seem obstructions. I have done away with pavements, walls, furniture, stone. I am in nothing and free. 7, I can make an expedition into the other world, which I still see as shadows, and at my leisure pretend I'm part of it. This gives an added fillip to my triumph. 8, I can talk my pains eloquently and fool people as to their cause and meaning. Again, the bad side being described here. 9, I can be a deceptive emperor, be present and not present in a room, know the time and not know the time, exist and not exist, and have myself, 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 while I fool everything and am not affected by anything.
Wow.
Okay, and then she goes, that is a description of the virus itself. And Steve reads, I could pretend I'm affected. And then 10, I sometimes call the ego no displeasure. It is what I want. I use pain from the world to get it. Pretend I haven't got it and justify my continuum to have an undrafted position. Okay, then finally he reads, this is a description of now the whole self. I should know this, the above, I know it, but I, the whole self, want the other pleasure. It is greater, it is honest, and it has more than this, and I don't have to use pain to get it. It does not make guilt. It is the really indescribable pleasure from seeing things wholly, honestly, wonderfully, humorously, excitingly, truly as they are. This pleasure would take the rest of time to describe. It is infinite. It is one a pleasure, real pleasure. Okay, and then my wife asked Steve, and this I think was the key to helping him. She goes, what do you think Mrs. Siegel is talking about? And Steve says, quote, what makes it come out? So,
yes.
As you can see, he understood that it was indeed his attitude which was having, you know, a bad effect on his life.
Yes.
He had the better choices to make. And basically what happened was after this consultation, believe it or not, the lesions on his face and his scalp cleared up. He even went to a dermatologist who tested it and said there was no longer evidence of the herpes infection. He wound up marrying his girlfriend. They wound up having a baby, believe it or not, healthy.
Love it.
And he went on with his life and with his career. So simply by understanding how his attitude could have been better, you know, how it might be leading to a depression of his immune system, why he was feeling so nervous and upset, and he had to look at himself and basically, as I said, the hardest thing here is to be critical of his own attitude. You know, where could I have a better attitude? And where am I hurting myself with this attitude? Where am I getting some pleasure from this pain that I'm getting from all this contempt I'm having for everything?
Yes.
And lo and behold, he also turned around.
Yes.
So,
and James, tell me, is there documented proof now that emotions and depression are directly connected to our immune system's ability to fight infections?
Yes, great question, Paul. There certainly is. And they've done studies. We also have it in the book, in our first chapter, in the Erasing Scars. And this is going back into the early 90s. What they discovered was they called a new study. It's called psychobioimmunology. So it's really talking about, and we describe it in the Erasing Scars introduction, you know, how your emotions are directly linked from connections from the brain to your immune system. And we list some documented studies that are in the book. This one, I'll read you this one right here quickly. Two scientists, this was from Glazer and Glazer, and basically what they studied was the effect of stress and depression on your blood counts, on your white blood cell counts, you know, which are the ones that fight infection. So specifically on your lymphocyte counts. So basically they took patients had a documented history of either depression or they were indicating they were severely under stress. And what they said here was they documented the decrease in the lymphocytes in patients under stress, they documented they were unable to fight off disease as well. There was another study by this group of scientists. These two leading authors were Kemeny and Cohen. And just a quote, they studied the relationship between stress and depression and genital herpes outbreaks. They documented the lowering of the CD4, which are the helper cells of lymphocyte, and also the CD8, which are the killer or cytotoxic type lymphocytes. So in patients that had high stress and patients that were depressed, okay, in the high stress patients, the killer lymphocytes were lowered or decreased, what we call the CD8 cells, and also in patients with that high levels of depression. So it says here the patients who were severely depressed were found to have higher rates of the herpes outbreak.
Wow.
So this is actually, and physically, you know, testing the blood, drawing the blood sample, checking the lymphocyte count. Basically, what they do with AIDS patients, you know, they check how high their or how low their lymphocyte count is. And so here, it turns out that they have actually documented if you're depressed and you're going to tend to have a lower or suppressed number of lymphocytes, and also if you're under tremendous stress.
Yes.
So I think all of us know that, you know, let's say you're studying for exams or you're having a lot of stress at home or problems with the children or whatever, you're under a lot of stress, that you might tend to pick up even the flu easier or a cold easier, that kind of thing. But to answer your question in a nutshell, yeah, they've actually and this really hasn't been, I don't think, put out as widespreadly as it should, but they've actually documented that in the blood sample, you have a lower number of two types of lymphocytes if you're chronically stressed or if you're chronically depressed.
Wow, I love it. Well, we have...
Isn't that something?
It is. It's fascinating. It really is. We have about 1 minute left. What would you like to share with the listeners, James, before we say goodbye?
Okay, Paul, again, thank you so much for having me today. It was an honor to be with you. I would just say, especially, you know, for the herpes condition, I think there is a lot of hope for patients out there. I'd highly recommend if you can pick up even an ebook copy of Erasing Scars, Herpes and Healing on Amazon.com. Again, I think that could help a lot. We have exercises in the book in which you can have a log and track down outbreaks for anybody that has this. For anybody else, also we talk a lot about the immune system and how to help with that and with attitude generally. And then also I highly recommend the book, our second book, The History of New Innovations in Modern Medicine. And again, that can help people understand how so many have struggled to help us with these medical innovations and basically learn a lot about different diseases and just increase your gratitude. So, again, really appreciate your having me on today, Paula. And I think either of those books would help everyone with their general health.
Yes, yes. Thank you so much, James. I'm really excited to share you and your books with everyone. To everyone out there, thank you for joining us. Love, hugs, blessings. James, love, hugs, blessings to you.
Thank you. Same to you, Paula. Thank you so much. And I really enjoyed the discussion. And thanks again.
Thank you. Goodbye, everyone.